Welcome to Pacific Hope with Pastor Gary Walton of Harvest Baptist Church on Guam. In this message from Isaiah chapter 6, we're ushered into God's throne room, where His holiness dominates the scene and exposes our deep brokenness. Like Isaiah, we're brought low, not to be crushed, but to receive mercy. When we grasp the greatness of God's holiness, we begin to see the beauty of His grace. Here is Pastor Gary Walton.
So Isaiah 6 gives us this really awesome sneak peek into the throne room of God. And as we have the opportunity this morning to sort of gaze around, I think we're going to see two things that dominate our view, our vision, as we look around Isaiah's description of the throne room of God. You know how when you walk into some place, maybe something like a showroom, maybe a auto showroom, and you walk into a room, maybe it's something else, and immediately when you walk in, there's all kinds of things going on in that space, but everything in that space is designed to draw your attention to one thing. Maybe it's the premier car in the fleet or something else that that room wants to draw your attention to. And so, I mean, you walk in, there's all kinds of stuff going on, but it just feels like everything's designed and your vision goes to one thing. Maybe it's that car, you know, right in the center of the showroom. And it's almost like you can't see anything else, all of the other things around you, because your attention is drawn to that one thing right there in the middle. Some of you probably experienced this the first time you met your spouse. Yeah. You walked into the room, and there was all kinds of other things. Maybe you met at a restaurant or a wedding, or I don't know where it was, but you walked in, and your first glance around the room, I mean, you could tell there's lots of stuff going on, but then you saw her, right? And it's like a spotlight beamed down on her, and everything else sort of fades away in your vision because that's all you can see is him or her in front of you. That really is the scene that we find and are introduced to here in Isaiah chapter 6. We're going to talk about two room-dominating sights. In Isaiah 6, this really cool sneak peek into the throne room of God, and Isaiah's going to give us a little visual tour of the place. We'll see a lot of things, but everything in the room is drawing attention to these two sights. Number one, it's the blinding brilliance of God's awesome holiness. And number two, the drop to your knees contrast of man's complete brokenness. So the key words for us this morning are going to be God's holiness and man's brokenness. And Isaiah 6, I think, is going to draw us into this throne room, and everything else in his vision is going to go away to draw us directly to these two things. So this morning, Isaiah is going to bring our attention to what I believe is the most important thing about God. All right, so track this. So the most important thing about you is what you think about God, and the most important thing about God is what we're going to talk about here in this chapter. So it really feels pretty clear to me that our conversation this morning is really, really important, right? It's narrowed it down to the most important things, maybe one of the most important things you will ever think about in your whole life. If you're ever going to figure life out, then I believe that you're going to have some concept of the biblical description of the holiness of God. Because if you don't have this concept, then nothing else is going to make sense. And I'd like to talk with you this morning about why I think that's true, and I think why Isaiah says that to us. When the Bible uses the word holy, it means to be set apart or to separate or to divide. So when we say or when we talk about holiness, we mean that God is separate from or set apart from something or someone, and that something is sin. So anytime you see the word or hear the word holy, you ought to think separation, and very specifically, it's separation from sin. God is totally apart from. He's has nothing to do with this separation from sin. All right, let's back up to verse 1 and just talk through this. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw also the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. So he's sitting, notice that. He's not pacing back and forth. God is not wringing his hands. God is not like us, you know, looking out over all the things that we have to do. God is not up in heaven looking out about all the massive things that he has to do in his week and wringing his hands and saying, what am I going to do about this? He's not pacing back and forth. He knows from the end from the beginning. He's not worried. He's not fretting. He's not anxious. He's God. He's in charge. He's holy, and he's sitting with everything under control. And he's sitting, according to Isaiah, high and lifted up. We'll read another passage in Ezekiel a little bit later about the same picture. I mean, he is high and lifted up. And then it says this, his train filled the temple. You're like, well, what's that all about? Is it a choo-choo train? or what is it, you know, that filled the temple? Well, the train is the train of a gown. I've officiated at quite a few weddings over the years. And, you know, most guys don't really understand all of the different parts of a wedding, like the train part. Ladies, just hear us out for a minute, all right? So it's the wedding dress, and it's beautiful, and then there's this thing like that drags along behind the dress, and it's really in the way. I mean, the whole time it's in the way, and you know, the ladies have to come and fluff it, or you know, they're moving it around, make sure it's straight, and every time she turns around, they got to come and move it again, right? So the train is this thing behind the wedding dress. In the wedding, the bride is the central picture, right? All the focus in a wedding is on the bride, and the train is what symbolizes, it's very symbolic of the glory of the bride. This is what Isaiah says about God's train. He doesn't just say that it, you know, kind of goes down behind him. He says this: the glory of the train of God the Father filled the temple. It filled the temple. And I don't know if that means like, you know, I don't really have a visual for it. Is it just that it was so glorious and so long and so broad that it just, everything in that whole temple room was filled with it? I don't know if it's like the train wrapped around back and forth, but I'm telling you, it filled the temple when Isaiah looked on it. And it wasn't just this idea that, you know, it's just a train for the sake of a train. Isaiah's trying to describe to us the glory of God the Father in his throne room, and his train filled the temple. Verse 2. And above it, this is above the throne, stood the seraphim. All right, the seraphim, we just sang about them a minute ago in the song Holy, Holy, Holy. The seraphim are these angelic beings that the Bible tells us that are around the throne room of God doing his bidding. Describes these angelic beings for us in this verse. The seraphim, each one had six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he did fly. And one cried unto another and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. You say, well, what's that all about? And I want to tell you this morning that it's all about God's holiness. Think with me about all of the things that God could have chosen to say about himself. God could have had the seraphs and the seraphim sing, loving, loving, loving God. And that would have been accurate. We would have said amen to that. And God could have said, had them say, merciful, merciful, merciful. And again, we would have said, right on, amen. We believe that. We've experienced the mercy of God and we've experienced the love of God. I'm guessing, though, that the seraphim don't have a whole lot of autonomy in the throne room of God. They're not making a lot of decisions for themselves. The seraphim are doing exactly what God the Father tells them to do, what he commands them to do. And I want you to know this morning that what is spoken in the presence of God is what God most wants said and understood about himself. And it is these words and nothing else forever. God has determined that the central defining characteristic of his being, the word that is going to be spoken in heaven and in his presence for eternity, is all about his holiness. In fact, Isaiah describes sort of these two angelic lines that are coming out from the throne. I mean, that's the picture, these seraphim in two lines coming out towards the viewer, coming out before the throne, and it says that one cries to another. Sort of like at a high school football game. If you've been to a high school football game where one side of the crowd sits on one side and one on the other, or a basketball game in an arena where each fan's base sits on one side or the other, and they cheer back and forth, right? We got spirit. Yes, we do. We got spirit. How about you? I should have you guys do that this morning, but we won't do that. We won't divide up. I've been to some arenas where the sound inside that place was so overwhelming that it like shakes you down to your bones. I've been to a whole bunch of college basketball arenas, and there is just nothing like some passionate, fanatic college basketball fans, students and fans that are, you know, in the middle of a heated Big Ten game or something else like that, and they are just full-throated, everything that they've got, cheering for the team. And I'm telling you, you've been there, right? You just feel it. It just envelops you. That's exactly what Isaiah is saying, except he's saying ramp that up 100 times. Isaiah is giving us this view into the throne room of God, and these two lines of seraphim are crying out to each other back and forth, responding to each other with this anthem of holiness. And then there's smoke, the verse says. And the posts of the door moved at the voice of him that cried, and the house was filled with smoke. And they're saying, holy, holy, holy. In Hebrew, the repetition of a term shows force. So if you were to say, hey, we had quite a storm last night, I mean, that would be one thing. But if you were to say that, you know, last night over on Saipan, they had a storm. Right, that's the Hebrew equivalent of ramping up the force of it. And if you were to say in Hebrew, the highest form of the greatness of this term, the modifier, if you were to say storm, that's exactly what these seraphim are saying. They're saying, holy, holy, holy. And we read verse 4, and can you get a hold of this scene? I mean, the foundations of the doors are trembling and the smoke is filling and the angels are thundering their praise back and forth. One guy said that the smoke You know, maybe it was really just to protect Isaiah lest he be consumed in the moment by the utter terror, by the majestic purity and majesty and unsearchable, unspeakable, and infinite holiness of God. The book of Exodus tells us that no man can look on God and live. I don't know. We're not told, but maybe that's what the smoke was there. It sort of shielded Isaiah from the infinite, majestic holiness of God himself so that he could survive. My friend, when was the last time that you thought about and considered God like this? In the incredible reality of his holy presence. Real quick, I want you to turn back over a few books to Ezekiel. Ezekiel chapter 1. We have another picture, and it's going to coincide, but another view of the throne of God in Ezekiel chapter 1. And I want to pick up the context by reading verse 1. Then we're actually going to skip towards the end. Ezekiel 1:1 says, "Now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, in the fifth day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river of Chebar, that the heavens were opened, and I, Ezekiel, saw visions of God." All right, so that's the context. Ezekiel saying, "I looked and I saw God." Go down to verse 26. "And above the firmament that was over their heads was the likeness of a throne, as the appearance of a sapphire stone, and upon the likeness of the throne was the likeness as the appearance of a man above upon it. And I saw as the color amber, as the appearance of fire round about within it, from the appearance of his loins even upward, and from the appearance of his loins even downward. I saw it as it were the appearance of fire, and it had brightness round about. And as the appearance of the bow that is in the cloud in the day of rain," right? The rainbow. He's looking on God's throne in this brilliant fire that he can hardly even describe. And he describes it sort of as the pictures of a rainbow. "This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord." And I've read all of that background for this. Ezekiel says, "And when I saw it, I fell upon my face." When I saw God and his majesty and his glory and his holiness, I had to get down low. There was no standing up. There was no showing how big and awesome I was. When I saw God like he really was, when I had a vision of the God of the Bible as in this way, I fell down low. I got as low as I could out of fear and utter terror of the holiness and the brightness of God. Isn't it easy for us to live with a very, very different view of God? Even in church. I mean, this high and exalted and lofty and exclusive character of God, I think sometimes even in church, we've lost sight of the character of God's holiness and what that means. All I know is that from the Bible and the book of Isaiah and the book of Ezekiel, and we're going to see it again in the book of Revelation, when the people stand before this vision of God, they get down low. Listen, God is not the man upstairs. He's not some big daddy or some casual view of God. He's not some cosmic buddy for us. And our God is a holy God. And when we view God in this way, man, it drops us low. So we see God in a certain way. Sometimes we view him sort of casually. Because of that, it messes up how we see ourselves. But when I see God like this, it actually helps my identity. I have a real perspective of who I am. Instead of the bloated, puff up my chest view of how awesome I am, if I can get a view of God in the way that the Bible describes it, in this holiness of his majesty, then I really know who I am, and that helps me in my identity. And my perspective now matches reality, and that always brings health to us. Verses 5 and 6 really are point 2. So we said the blinding brilliance of God's awesome holiness, which brings us to the drop to your knees contrast of man's complete brokenness. And this key word of brokenness, read verse 5 with me. And then said I, Isaiah says, woe is me, for I am undone, because I'm a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For mine eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. Man, when I see the King, when I see the Lord of hosts, the only response that I have is not, hey, how great am I? The only response is woe is me. David said it this way in Psalm 130 and verse 3. He said, if you, Lord, should mark iniquities, who can stand? Listen to me, Christian, or maybe somebody that's here searching and you're trying to work through this idea of sin, and maybe the whole idea of sin is kind of confusing for you. I want you to know this morning, in the light of the holiness of God, in the view of our sin, God is saying, it's not that I'm trying to make things hard on you. I'm trying to protect you, because sin's going to destroy your life. It just keeps coming and coming and coming. It's never satisfied. It always wants more. That is the characteristic of sin, and you see it all throughout the Bible. And all you got to do is look around the world, and you'll see it over and over and over again. It is ravenous, and it will ravage your soul. All of the pain, all of the heartache in this world, every last bit of it is the result of sin. Don't be fooled. Please don't be fooled that the thing that your heart so desires and you feel guilty about when you do it, that guilt is not God trying to make you feel miserable. That guilt is God protecting you. Look around, man. Sin destroys. It has always destroyed, and it will destroy anything that's good in your life. It will take it away. That's what it does. And I'm not saying that there's not pleasure in sin for a season. But the ultimate end for both the believer and the unbeliever is always destruction. We're turning the corner here. Here's the best part of all this, because this whole text is building on itself, because we can't get verse 6 until we understand verse 5. Because in this thunderous, majestic, overwhelming view of the holiness of God, I want you to see that mercy and grace are wrapped up in here too. And I want you to know and see this sort of beam of light that's just slowly making its way out of the woe that Isaiah's describing before us. And you say, what are you talking about? I don't see any beam of light. All I see is woe. And I'd say this. We can never really understand what God's mercy and grace mean and how unbelievably awesome God's forgiveness is until we get Isaiah's vision of God's holiness. You're never going to really understand what God's done for you and be able to accept the gift of his forgiveness until we first come to the place where God's holiness gets us down low on our knees. Woe is me, I am broken. And until sin puts us to that point, and God, and a view of God's holiness puts us to that point to understand that I'm broken, then we'll never, never, never understand how unbelievably incredible the mercy and grace and forgiveness of God is. Verse 6, then flew one of the seraphims unto me, having a live coal in his hand, which he had taken with the tongs from off the altar. And this is all symbolic, so hang with me on here. But he laid it upon my mouth and said, lo, this hath touched your lips, and your iniquity is taken away, and your sin is purged. Why did the seraphim fly to Isaiah? Because God told him to. I'm pretty sure he didn't make this up on his own. He didn't make this decision on his own, because into Isaiah's brokenness, God brought his forgiveness. And do we have a few testimonies this morning of this kind of action God doing in our own lives? Into this brokenness of our lives, God brings the coal, the fire of his forgiveness. And that, my friend, is what God has been doing for ages. And that is what he's offering to us today. The New Testament tells us that about 2,000 years ago, God sent his only son to earth, and he laid down his life on the cross, on the altar, as you will, just like this one. He laid his life down on the altar, and through his life and his death, God offers forgiveness to anyone that will believe. I want to finish up with one more throne room scene. I'm going to have you go all the way to the end of the book of Revelation. Revelation chapter 20 and verse 11. John the Apostle telling about a vision that he saw that gives us the end of the story, right? Got the revelation of God's work in this world. And John says in Revelation 20, 11, "And I saw a great white throne." This is at the end of the world. And him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. John says, verse 12, "And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were opened. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged out of those things which are written in the books, according to their works." There's going to be a place in eternity where there will be a judgment and a determination. And it's called the Great White Throne, this holiness of God. The earth and the heavens are going to flee away from it. And in that place of God's holiness and God's justice, he's going to open up the book and he's going to read from it. And every person, small and great, who's ever lived, will stand before the judge and hear whether their name is written in the book of life. So my question for you this morning, is your name written there?
Thanks for listening to Pacific Hope with Pastor Gary Walton. Pacific Hope is a production of Harvest Baptist Church and Harvest Family Radio. If you'd like to learn more about Harvest Baptist Church, visit hbcguam.org. To learn more about Harvest Family Radio or Pacific Hope, visit khmg.org. Harvest Ministries is located on Guam and exists to help people develop a heart for God. It is our hope that this message has played a part in doing just that. Again, thanks for listening to this episode of Pacific Hope.